Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the two-week issue dated September 6th, September 13th, 2024. The cover drawing this week is quite busy. I'll see if I can give you the gist of it. We have the Democratic donkey. He's got on a blue T-shirt with an American flag on it and a Harris Waltz 2024 button. He's got a red and blue USA ball cap. He's got a bald eagle on his shoulder. The eagle has a football helmet on that's painted like an American flag. In his left hand, the donkey's holding up an American flag, and he is, his right hand, he's saluting. He's saluting three fighter jets that are flying by against a beautiful background. One has a red trail, one has a white trail, one has a blue trail. Lots of red, white, and blue today. The headline is, "The New Brand. Can Democrats win as a patriotic, hawkish party?" That's our controversy of the week. This is one of those two-week issues. They won't publish a new one next week, so we'll get two readings out of this, starting with the more current stuff today. So let's do the main stories and how they were covered. Trump-Harris sprint through swing states. What happened? With only 10 weeks until Election Day and polls showing the race in a virtual tie, Donald Trump and Kamala Harris hit the campaign trail this week in battleground states that could decide the election. Harris and running mate Tim Walz launched a two-day bus tour of Georgia, seeking to erode Trump's dwindling margins in a state that jumped back into Democrats' reach after President Biden decided not to seek re-election. Trump headed for Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, where his campaign team hoped to put him in front of smaller crowds rather than large rallies where he tends to veer off script. Advisors have urged Trump to stop his personal attacks on Harris and focus on policy. But in North Carolina last week, he mocked her efforts, asking the crowd if they preferred a focus on politics or personal insults, and joking, "My advisors are fired," when they cheered for the latter. On his Truth Social platform, Trump shared crude sexual memes about Harris and Hillary Clinton and numerous posts that were promoted the QAnon conspiracy theory. Polls suggested Harris was building momentum after last week's Democratic convention. The Cook Political Report moved North Carolina from leans Republican to toss-up, while shifting New Hampshire and Minnesota to likely Democrat. But national polling put the race in a near dead heat, with Harris ahead by about 2 to 3 percentage points. Meanwhile, wrangling continued over an ABC News debate planned for September 10th. After vacillating, Trump said he'd reached an agreement to debate Comrade Kamala Harris. But Harris aide said negotiations were ongoing over whether candidates' microphones will be muted when they are not speaking, a policy favored by Trump's camp and opposed by Harris. What the editorial said. At the Democratic convention, Harris built a strong case for her candidacy, said the Washington Post. She spoke of uniting Americans around our highest aspirations and building an opportunity economy where everyone has a chance to compete. It's an appealing-sounding vision on which she will have to elaborate in the coming weeks. Democrats are charged up at how Harris has transformed the race and energized voters, but now she must tell us how she'll pursue these lofty goals. Harris offered a paint-by-numbers collection of cliches, said National Review. She'll fight for America. She'll boost the middle class. She spoke of policy in only the gauziest of terms, vowing to solve the housing crisis and curb inflation without saying exactly how. It drives home how no major party nominee in recent memory has ever been such a complete cipher. Her obvious phoniness and record of far-left positions gives Trump plenty of openings, but he's hamstrung by his utter lack of discipline. What the columnist said. Trump is blowing a winnable election, said Nicole Russell in USA Today. Unlike Harris, he has a strong record to run on and can boast he cut taxes and stocked the Supreme Court with qualified conservative justices. And he can exploit the weaknesses of a candidate who can be tied to the Biden administration's failures and who backs socialist-style price controls that would lurch the nation leftward. But he's a self-obsessed, unfocused communicator who stews in grievance and can't or won't mount an effective attack. Harris has been light on substance, said Ramesh Ponuru in the Washington Post. But what about Trump? His campaign website points to the GOP platform, which offers hazy promises to stabilize the economy and restore peace through strength, with zero policy details. Pundits saying Harris can't win on vibe or dead wrong, said Nia Malika Henderson in Bloomberg. Most voters are too busy with jobs and family to read candidates' white papers. What they do focus on is how a candidate makes them feel. And Harris' message of uplift is connecting with millions. The Democrat is on a winning streak, said Patrick Healy in the New York Times. But consider this. While she's packed arenas with adoring crowds in recent weeks, she's still only a few points ahead of Trump nationally, and the pair are effectively tied in the seven swing states that will decide the election. And there's plenty of time for the dynamics of the race to change, especially if an October surprise shifts voter attention to safety or national security. Harris faces many tests ahead, including the televised September 10th face-off. Debates can change things in an instant. Just ask Joe Biden. Israel strikes at Hezbollah and West Bank militants. What happened? Israel and Hezbollah edged away from all-out war this week after their heaviest exchange of fire in months. But the region remained tense as Israeli troops launched a major military operation in the occupied West Bank. Israel struck Iran-backed Hezbollah with about 100 warplanes, bombing over 40 launch sites in southern Lebanon in an effort to avert what it described as an imminent Hezbollah strike. Hezbollah responded by aiming hundreds of drones and rockets at Israeli military sites, most of which were shot down. The exchange appeared to satisfy Hezbollah's need to make a show of retaliation for Israel's killing of its senior commander, Fuad Shukr, in a July airstrike in Beirut. But the risk remained that Iran could still seek retribution against Israel for the assassination of Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh while he was visiting Tehran in July. We continue to assess that there is a threat of attacks, said Pentagon spokesman General Patrick Ryder. Just days after the attack on Hezbollah, Israeli forces sent hundreds of troops into the occupied West Bank, surrounding Tulkarem and Jenin, two hotbeds of Palestinian militancy. At least 10 Palestinians were killed and dozens arrested. Israel also pushed further into southern and central Gaza this week, ordering evacuations that further concentrated displaced Palestinians into crowded camps. While searching a Hamas tunnel, Israeli forces came upon Farhan al-Qadi, an Israeli Arab taken hostage on October 7th, and freed him. Hamas still holds more than 100 hostages, though, and ceasefire negotiations to free them continue. What the columnist said. Israel's preemptive strike against Hezbollah came just in time, said Andrew C. McCarthy in National Review. Hezbollah was on the verge of firing what could have been up to thousands of missiles and drones, many aimed at Tel Aviv. Thanks to Iranian support, the militant group has up to 150,000 missiles and 50,000 fighters, and they pose an existential threat to Israel. Iran, meanwhile, may not strike at all, with Israel weakened by fighting on two fronts, Gaza and Lebanon, and the U.S. pressing for a premature ceasefire. Tehran is effectively winning by going it slow. Fortunately, the calculated escalation by Israel and Hezbollah did not derail the Gaza ceasefire talks, said David Ignatius in the Washington Post. Negotiations in Cairo continued to inch forward even as the rockets flew. The bargaining now concerns the final details, such as the names of the Palestinian prisoners to be traded for hostages. Gaza remains a tragedy that compounds every day, but at least the momentum toward peace continues. Yet the West Bank is rapidly developing into a third battle front, said Anat Peled and Kerry Keller Lynn in the Wall Street Journal. Hundreds of Palestinians have been killed in the territory since the Gaza war began by airstrikes, Israeli troops, or settler violence. And anger is growing. Israel says Iran has been deploying terrorist infrastructure there by smuggling weapons through Jordan. But if Israel's aim is to prevent another major arena of fighting from emerging, sending in troops threatens to do just that. New indictment filed against Trump in January 6 case. What happened? Special Counsel Jack Smith this week filed a streamlined indictment against Donald Trump over his alleged attempts to overturn the 2020 presidential election in a bid to prove the case remains viable despite a Supreme Court ruling in July granting presidents broad immunity for actions taken in office. The revised United States versus Trump indictment, pared down from 45 pages to 36, and delivered by a new grand jury, retains all the original charges, but zeroes in on actions that Smith determined to be those of a private candidate. Smith excised allegations about Trump's push for the Justice Department to back his claims of election fraud, an action that the Supreme Court ruled falls within a president's core duties and thus absolutely immune from prosecution. Smith also appealed U.S. District Court Judge Eileen Cannon's July 15th dismissal of Trump's classified documents case in a ruling that said Smith's appointment was unconstitutional. Smith cited more than 150 years of precedent to argue otherwise. On Truth Social, Trump condemned deranged Jack Smith and his effort to resurrect a dead witch hunt. He also redoubled attacks on political foes, reposting a string of memes from supporters, including images of Democratic leaders in orange jumpsuits. What the columnist said, "This is legal terrain never seen before, so Smith knew to choose his words carefully," said Sean Wu in the Daily Beast, removing references to warnings from White House advisors about Trump's criminal liability. The indictment now passively states that Trump was on notice that his claims were untrue. Trump talks with Vice President Mike Pence are framed as those of a candidate and his running mate. This round of word games really points to the absurdity of the Supreme Court's immunity decision. Smith actually hasn't ceded much ground, said Andrew C. McCarthy in National Review. The revised indictment dubiously insists there are bright lines separating the actions of incumbent presidential candidates and chief executives. It downplays presumptive immunity surrounding Trump's urging Pence not to certify in an effort to get around the court's explicit statement that whenever the president and vice president discuss their official responsibilities, they engage in official conduct. What's more, the court expressly forbids prosecutors from examining the motives behind a president's official acts. Yet, that's just what Smith does. Even if the indictment passes U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan's review for immunity conflicts, it still faces major political obstacles, said David A. Graham in The Atlantic. It won't be tried until after the election, and Trump's team could appeal it right back up to the same sympathetic Supreme Court. But Smith clearly isn't backing down from pursuing the two federal cases unless Trump wins the election and simply quashes them. Sometimes the things the president can do legally are the most disturbing. Controversy of the week. Harris, will her patriotic pitch win over the center? Not bad, Madam Vice President, said William Crystal in the Bulwark. Pretty damn impressive, in fact. Kamala Harris wrapped up last week's Democratic National Convention with a stirring address that established her as a vigorous, centrist, and unabashedly patriotic leader. Everything that Donald Trump is not. As flag-waving delegates in the Chicago arena chanted, USA, USA, the Democratic presidential nominee reintroduced herself as a child of immigrants whose story, she explained, could only be written in the greatest nation on earth. She spoke of the privilege and pride of being an American, vowed to bolster border security, and called for optimism and faith in the fight for American ideals. Yes, this was a Democrat talking, said Peter Hamby and Puck. There were, of course, peons to diversity and pluralism, but Harris' audience was the suburban middle, the deciders, and they seemed to like what she's saying. An early post-convention poll of Democrats, Republicans, and Independents shows Harris only one percentage point behind Trump on attributes that previously favored the Republican nominee, such as being a strong leader and keeping the country safe. And on Trump's weakest attributes, honesty, temperament, compassion, she's far outperforming President Biden. Harris the hawk has landed, said Fred Kaplan in Slate. She pledged to build and maintain the world's most lethal fighting force and blasted her Republican opponent for cozying up to foreign autocrats because he wants to be an autocrat himself. It was a clever strategy designed to defang the contentious stereotype, which Trump frequently gins up, that women are too weak to stand up to strong, dangerous men. Other speakers, including former Defense Secretary Leon Panetta, and Arizona Senator Mark Kelly, a former Navy combat pilot, blew holes in that stereotype by making the case on national security grounds against Trump and for Harris. The risk is that Democrats will alienate key parts of the base as they rush to reclaim true American patriotism, said Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Inquirer. Harris lamented the suffering in Gaza, but ignored calls to include a Palestinian speaker at the DNC, which could haunt her in a tight race if even a sliver of young voters or Arab American voters stay home. Color me as confused as ever, said Michael Goodwin in the New York Post. Beyond boilerplate patriotism, Harris provided zero details on how she will govern. Will she forswear the extreme policies she pushed in her flop 2019 presidential campaign, such as abolishing immigration and customs enforcement? How does she plan to fix the mess she and Biden made of the economy, other than a socialistic attack on price gouging and other supposed big business evils? I'll admit Harris did a pretty good job of talking to America in her scripted speech, said Peggy Noonan in the Wall Street Journal. Now she has to do it every day. And when she gets into policy specifics, mainstream voters may well see her as further to the left than they want to go. But Harris has proved that she's a majoritarian at heart, said E.J. Dion Jr. in the Washington Post. Just look at the coalition she assembled in Chicago. It included conservatives like former GOP Representative Adam Kinzinger and progressives such as Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, business leaders, and union bosses. All spoke up for Harris and the idea that pluralistic democracy is good and worth defending. It's a simple and obvious message that, in an age of Trumpian toxic division, somehow feels entirely fresh. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for Real Talk. After the world's oldest man, Britain's John Tenniswood, 112, attributed his longevity to just luck, saying, "You either live long or you live short, and you can't do much about it." It was a good week for switch hitters after catcher Danny Jansen became the first player in Major League Baseball history to play for both teams in one game. Jansen began the season with the Toronto Blue Jays, whose June 26 matchup with the Boston Red Sox was suspended during the second inning by rain. When the game resumed this week, Jansen had been traded to the Red Sox, who went on to lose 4-1 to the Blue Jays. And it was a good week for relics after Donald Trump announced that fans who spend $1,485 on his digital trading cards will receive a piece of the suit he wore at his debate with President Biden, calling it a true collector's item. But it was a bad week for taking your kid to work after an Austrian surgeon allegedly let his 13-year-old daughter drill a hole in a patient's skull during emergency surgery. While the operation was a success, the unnamed victim's lawyer called the situation simply undignified. It was a bad week for metaphors after Missouri's Department of Conservation gave an update on the condition of a bald eagle recently rescued for rehabilitation. The iconic bird was not, in fact, injured, the MDC said, but merely engorged with raccoon. In other words, too fat to fly. Finally, it was a bad week for beta males after a Taliban minister announced that 281 beardless men had been dismissed from Afghanistan's security forces in the past year. One anonymous fired officer told a reporter that he'd faced lots of harassment over my inability to grow a beard. And we will do the U.S. at a glance and the world at a glance. I think we've got about 9 short pieces. Starting with the U.S. at a glance from Silver Springs, Maryland. New boosters. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved new Moderna and Pfizer COVID vaccines last week amid a nationwide surge in the virus. The updated mRNA vaccines approved for people ages 6 months and older target the virus' latest mutation, KP.2, a strain that has produced the highest infection rate since 2022. 45 states currently have high or very high levels of infection measured in wastewater. Hospitalizations, however, remain low. Though U.S. officials have recommended the vaccines for all individuals, regardless of risk status, recent uptake has been low. Last year, only 1 in 5 U.S. adults got the vaccine booster, and just 40% of Americans ages 75 and over who are most at risk. The vaccines will be made available to the uninsured for free by the Centers for Disease Control, which has allocated $62 million to provide states with the shots. Hampstead, New Hampshire. Deadly infections. A New Hampshire resident died this week after testing positive for the Eastern Equine Encephalitis virus. The rare but potentially deadly condition is passed by infected mosquitoes, causing severe central nervous system disease, said New Hampshire health officials. An octogenarian man in Oxford, Massachusetts, and a resident of Chittenden County, Vermont, have also been infected. Communities in the affected areas are closing public parks before mosquitoes become active and urging residents to stay indoors after dark. The virus can cause flu-like symptoms such as fever, chills, and muscle aches, and joint pain, as well as encephalitis and meningitis. Approximately one-third of all people who develop encephalitis from the virus die from the infection. Survivors may experience lifelong physical or mental issues. There is no vaccine or antiviral treatment, so authorities recommend wearing long sleeves and pants outside and avoiding outdoor activities at daybreak and dusk. Madison, West Virginia. Football deaths. A 13-year-old West Virginia middle schooler died last week after a collision during football practice, the latest in a spate of at least five student football deaths this month. Cohen Craddock was playing on the defensive line when he attempted to tackle another player and struck his head on the ground, said his father, Ryan, who described Cohen as Mr. Personality with a big heart, big teddy bear. Ryan urges football helmet makers to add an extra level of protection, saying his son would have had a totally different outcome in a helmet with extra padding. On the same day that Ryan died, high school quarterback Caden Tellier, 16, was tackled during his team's season opener in Selma, Alabama, and died after what appeared to be a blood vessel rupture. Three other high school players died this month practicing in the heat, including another Alabama player, Samaj Wilkins, 14, who collapsed in the first 15 minutes of a practice session. The world at a glance. This is in Ottawa. No strike allowed. The Canadian government forced an end last week to a 17-hour work stoppage involving 10,000 rail workers that had threatened to disrupt shipments of cars, timber, fuel, and grain across Canada and the United States. The Labor Ministry ordered the Teamsters Union and the nation's two largest rail companies, Canadian Pacific Kansas City Railroad and the Canadian National Railway, into binding arbitration to end a dispute over a new contract the union said would compromise rail safety and workers' health. The companies had briefly locked out the workers, who had been without a contract since the end of 2023, after negotiations broke down. The rights of Canadian workers have been significantly diminished today, said Paul Boucher of the Teamsters. Large companies need only stop their operations for a few hours, inflict short-term economic pain, and the federal government will step in to break a union. Miranda, Brazil. Wetlands ablaze. Wildfires have blackened 7,000 square miles, an area as large as New Jersey, and killed endangered animals in Brazil's Pantanal, the world's biggest tropical wetland and one of its most important biodiversity sanctuaries. The wetland is normally flooded, but it has been dried out by years of drought blamed on deforestation and climate change. And fires have been burning for months. A UNESCO World Heritage Site covering 68,000 square miles, the Pantanal is home to threatened species like the giant otter, as well as the world's highest concentrations of jaguars and caimans. We're watching the biodiversity of the Pantanal disappear into ash, said Gustavo Figueroa of the conservation nonprofit SOS Pantanal. This is from Rabat, Morocco. Farmers can grow weed. Morocco's King Mohammed VI issued a mass pardon last week to nearly 5,000 farmers convicted or wanted on charges of illegally growing marijuana. The leniency was part of a push by the North African nation, already a leading cannabis producer, to increase its share of the global marijuana market. Morocco legalized production and medical use of marijuana in 2021, and its first legal harvest 2 years later reaped 294 tons. But in the Rif region, where the plant has been grown and smoked mixed with tobacco for centuries, some 120,000 families harvest around 100,000 tons a year. If they can now join the export trade, cannabis revenues should soar. Morocco hopes to capture 15% of the European market and generate $630 million in annual revenue by 2028. Medical marijuana is legal in most European Union countries. This is from Kharkiv, Ukraine. Russian assault. Russia this week launched its biggest bombardment of Ukraine yet in retaliation for Kyiv's incursion into its Kursk region, hurling more than 200 missiles and drones at 15 of Ukraine's 24 regions. Ukraine used its U.S.-made F-16 fighter jets, donated by Denmark earlier this year, to shoot down some of the Russian missiles, although many got through and hit Kharkiv and other areas, killing 11 people. The attacks were aimed at Ukrainian infrastructure, and they knocked out power and water in some areas. Meanwhile, Russia redeployed 30,000 troops that had been fighting in southern and eastern Ukraine to Kursk. Ukrainian forces, now in their third week of the offensive in Kursk, have seized some 500 square miles of territory and are trying to expand their attack into neighboring Russian province of Belgorod. Beijing threatening Japan, Philippines. China made aggressive moves against both Japan and the Philippines this week, part of a pattern of growing belligerence. A Chinese spy plane briefly violated Japanese airspace off Nagasaki in what Japan called the first ever incursion into its skies by the Chinese military. Japan said Chinese aircraft had buzzed Japanese borders, though without crossing, hundreds of times in the past year. And in the South China Sea, Chinese ships rammed two Philippine vessels near the Sabina Shoal, a reef both countries claim, ripping holes in the ship's sides. The Philippines called China the biggest disruptor of peace in the region, while Japan lambasted Beijing as a threat to our safety. Kabul. Silence, women. Afghanistan's Taliban rulers have imposed their most draconian measures on women yet, barring them from even speaking in public. The rules classify female voices as intimate and bar women from singing or reading loudly enough to be heard in public, even if they are inside their own homes. The new vice and virtue laws not only require women to wear burqas and full veils, but also forbid them to look directly at any man who isn't a relative. Women and girls were already barred from leaving home unaccompanied by a male relative, working in most jobs, or attending school beyond age 12. The restrictions are incredibly frightening, said human rights activist Fawzia Kufi, yet the whole world acts like this is normal. New Delhi. Shed that colonial tradition. The Hindu nationalist government of Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has banned British-style caps and gowns from some graduation ceremonies, calling them a colonial legacy. The health ministry said in a letter to state medical colleges last week that students should wear appropriate Indian dress at commencement. And the government body that regulates universities suggested graduates choose colorful, hand-loomed garments for the ceremonies to give a sense of pride of being Indian. Modi started calling for such changes 2 years ago as part of his push to remove what he called any trace of the colonial mindset. His government has also renamed streets and towns, and abolished the playing of bagpipes at military dinners. We will read a few of the columns this week and then maybe circle back next week and pick up a few of the others. Start off with two from the U.S. The duty of Trump's former aides. One of the most powerful speakers at the Democratic National Convention last week was a Republican, said Tim Miller. Former Georgia Lieutenant Governor Jeff Duncan described how he needed armed police officers to protect his home after he refused to go along with Donald Trump's attempt to change the state's election results in 2020. Doing the right thing will never be the wrong thing, Duncan told his son. Other Republicans also took the stage to explain why Trump is a threat to democracy. But where were Trump's former cabinet officials? Jim Mattis, who served as Trump's first defense secretary, has in the past called Trump dangerous and unfit. Former Chief of Staff John Kelly has described Trump as the most flawed person he's ever met. Former Vice President Mike Pence was nearly killed by the January 6 mob Trump unleashed. So why had they gone silent? They probably worry that attacking Trump will endanger their personal safety and lead to an inconvenient media furor. But they owe it to the country to do the right thing and tell Americans what they know better than anyone. Trump is an existential threat to our system of government. The predators in women's prisons. No woman in America's prisons should have to share a cell with a biological male, said National Review. But in many state prison systems, male prisoners can get transferred to women's prisons simply by declaring that their gender identity is now female. Under the guise of inclusion, in other words, male felons with violent criminal histories have been granted access to vulnerable women to prey upon. This trans insanity has led to dozens of sexual assaults and complaints of sexual harassment involving these supposedly trans inmates. In Washington State's women's prison, three trans felons, including one who was serving time for assaulting his 9-year-old sister, have been accused of sexually abusing women inmates. In Pennsylvania, 4 female inmates filed a lawsuit after being forced to share a cell with a trans inmate who allegedly sexually harassed and groped them. On and on it goes. In California, nearly 300 offenders in male prisons who now identify as trans or non-binary, are seeking transfers to women's institutions. A third of them are registered sex offenders. This is clearly wrong. Female inmates should be guaranteed a facility free from men in which to pay their debt to society. This comes from Sudan. Why it's easier to get weapons than food. Sudan's starving millions might have one last shred of hope, said Mawalib Abdennatif in the East African. Peace talks in Geneva ended last week with no truce between the Sudanese army and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, the RSF. No surprise, since the army didn't even show up. But the army did tell intermediaries it would send representatives to new agenda-setting talks in Egypt. The talks also cleared the way for 15 aid trucks to cross from Chad into Sudan's western Darfur region. Still, that first convoy carried only enough aid for 13,000 people, and there are 750,000 Sudanese on the brink of starvation. 500,000 of those are crammed into Darfur's Zamzam refugee camp in an area under RSF siege. Meanwhile, natural disasters like a dam collapse near Port Sudan this week that killed dozens of people continually set back aid efforts. By year's end, famine experts fear 2.5 million of Sudan's 48 million people could be dead. There are no quick fixes in this conflict, said Damian McElroy in the National. But addressing the famine is a vital first step. Since the war began in April 2023, 10 million people have been displaced within Sudan, and another 2.3 million have fled to neighboring countries. All of these people must be fed, but militias have burned crops, looted seeds, and blocked aid convoys. To meet this vast need, every road needs to be opened, from Port Sudan, from South Sudan, and across the desert from Libya and Egypt, said Alex DeWall in BBC.com. Relief agencies will also need a huge infusion of cash to deliver enough food to make a difference everywhere famine looms. But the Sudanese people will not have long-term relief until both sides put down their guns and end their pillage and extortion. And there is no sign that they are willing to do this. That's because this conflict has morphed into a proxy war, said Le Monde from France in an editorial. Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Iran support the army, led by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. The United Arab Emirates and Russia, which covet Sudan's gold and Red Sea access, are backing the RSF, a rebel force rooted in the Arab Janjaweed militia that perpetrated genocide in Darfur 2 decades ago. With the country awash in weapons from these states and others, the fighting has metastasized into multiple local conflicts, rekindling age-old ethnic tensions between Arab and black populations. At this point, weapons proliferate and circulate more easily than staple foods. Even when food arrives, it's all but impossible to distribute, said the Sudan Media Forum. When the warring parties aren't confiscating and diverting supplies for their own use, they are cutting off the internet and telecoms so that aid groups can't communicate. And reliable information about what areas are safe is hard to come by, because the few journalists who've managed to get in are kept under strict surveillance. We need more reporters to tell Sudan's story. One reason why the humanitarian situation is so dire is that the world doesn't have to look at it. We'll read some of the business news this week. Economy, Fed signals start of interest rate cuts. Move over inflation, said Jeffrey Bartash in Market Watch. Unemployment is the Federal Reserve's biggest enemy now. In a speech from Jackson Hole, Wyoming last week, Fed Chairman Jerome Powell declared firmly that the time has come to cut rates after more than a year of keeping the central bank's key rate above 5%. The risks of inflation have diminished, Powell said, but he wasn't yet celebrating victory. Focus has shifted from reining in prices to preventing a weakening labor market from pushing the economy into a recession. Unemployment has experienced a surprising surge, rising to a nearly three-year high of 4.3% in July. And last week, the government said the economy had created 818,000 fewer jobs than previously reported, an alarming revision. Powell's inflation crusade has reached the end game, said Gabriel Rubin in Reuters. The soft landing is in sight, but this is also where the possibility of failure is at its most dangerous. Powell made it clear last week that he has, at last, seen enough of inflation's downward trajectory, and it is time to support job growth. While the Fed chairman's wording was careful, it suggested that any cooling in the labor market conditions will provoke a response and swift rate cuts to save jobs. We may be at a major turning point, and those rate cuts can't come soon enough. Legends. Berkshire Hathaway reaches $1 trillion value. Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway this week became the first non-tech company in the U.S. to attain a value of $1 trillion, said Yun Lee in CNBC.com. The 94-year-old Buffett's conglomerate joins Apple, Nvidia, Microsoft, Alphabet, Amazon, and Meta in the 13-figure club. Even though Buffett has been in a defensive mode as of late, dumping a massive amount of stock, including half of his Apple stake. Berkshire owns BNSF Railway, Geico Insurance, and Dairy Queen, among other holdings. Its stock has rallied more than 28% in 2024. Pharma. Lilly to sell cut rate weight loss drugs. Eli Lilly has cut prices on its weight loss drug, signaling a possible price war with online pharmacies, said Madison Muller in Bloomberg. To overcome supply shortages of the wildly popular shots, Lilly said this week it will sell vials of Zepbound doses for as little as $399, more than 50% below the price of its injector pens. With vials, patients need to fill syringes on their own, but it saves Lilly production time. Because of shortages of weight loss drugs such as Zepbound and Wegovy, the FDA has let compounding pharmacies sell versions online that often cost much less than the brand name drugs. COVID. Zuckerberg said Meta faced pressure to censor. Mark Zuckerberg said federal officials repeatedly pressured his company to censor certain COVID content during the pandemic, said Will Oramus in the Washington Post. Meta CEO wrote in a letter to the House Judiciary Committee this week that he believed it was wrong for senior White House officials to push his company to remove posts, including humor and satire, though the ultimate decision to take down the controversial material was the company's own. House Republicans greeted Zuckerberg's letter as a victory, calling it a big win for free speech. Auto bargains amid a surplus of cars. Now is the time to buy a new car, said Pete Grieve in Money. After a pandemic-related shortage, production is up more than 40% from last year, a shift that means car shopping is becoming normal again, because automakers will likely need to reduce their margins to avoid building up too much inventory. Car shoppers should be able to negotiate discounts as well as take advantage of incentive deal like a cashback rebate or subsidized financing. But don't expect the same sticker prices as several years ago. They are still 20% higher compared with the winter of 2020. High auto loan rates also remain, though that may change, as the Federal Reserve has signaled that interest rate cuts are coming in September. I'm going to read one of the obituaries. The entrepreneur who became Famous Amos. Wally Amos, 1936-2024. As a talent agent in the early 1970s, working with artists like Dionne Warwick and the Temptations, Wally Amos went to meet record company execs bearing chocolate chip cookies he made from his beloved aunt's recipe. Pretty soon everybody was asking for them, he said. Spotting an opportunity, he switched careers to open his own store, Famous Amos, in Hollywood. That first outlet spawned dozens of franchise stores and became a national brand sold in supermarkets. And by 1981, the business was bringing in $12 million a year, about $42 million in today's dollars. If the cookie's homemade taste and lack of artificial ingredients were part of the appeal, so was Amos himself. A pioneering brand ambassador known for his Panama hats, colorful shirts with a kazoo in his pocket, and upbeat banter. He chatted with everyone, even the cookies. I talked to them, you know, he once said. Encouraged them with things like, now bake nice. He was born in Tallahassee, where his father worked for the electric company and his mother was a house cleaner, said the Washington Post. When they divorced, he moved to Harlem at age 12 to live with his aunt. Inspired by her baking skills, he took cooking apprenticeships in high school, but felt that white students were given better opportunities. He dropped out and joined the Air Force, then took a mailroom job at the William Morris Talent Agency. After rising to become its first black agent, he left to start his own agency in Los Angeles in 1967. The job was all-consuming, and he baked at night to relieve stress, said the New York Times. Buoyed by the love for his cookies and investments from former clients like singer Marvin Gaye, he opened Famous Amos on Sunset Boulevard. Opening day drew thousands, and within years, he was a household name, appearing on the cover of Time. Amos struggled as a business person as he expanded, said The Guardian. He began selling off his equity stakes, and in 1988 sold out to a private equity firm for $3 million. Moving to Hawaii, he went on to sell baked goods under other names, including Uncle Wally's Muffin Company and the Cookie Kahuna. He never equaled his early success, but didn't seem bothered. Being famous is highly overrated, he said in 2014. I am fortunate that, through all the ups and downs that I've experienced, I still make a cookie that tastes good. And we've got time for one of the Talking Points articles. Let's go with RFK Jr. Will his endorsement matter? Could Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s endorsement of Donald Trump tip the scales in key battleground states, asked Hannah Trudeau and Julia Mueller in The Hill. With his polls in free fall and money running out, the anti-vaxxer and conspiracy theorist ended his third-party candidacy last week. RFK Jr. endorsed Trump in return for an honorary position as co-chair of Trump's transition team and a vague promise of a role in a second Trump administration. In recent weeks, RFK Jr.'s poll support has plunged from roughly 10% to about 4%, amid a series of embarrassing stories, including his confession he once had a brain worm and his dumping of a dead bear in New York City's Central Park. Still, Republican strategists said RFK Jr.'s support might add two or three crucial points to Trump's total in battleground states. The impact of Kennedy's support shouldn't be underestimated, said Philip Klein in National Review. In 2020, three key swing states, Arizona, Georgia, and Wisconsin, were decided by a collective 43,000 votes. When Kamala Harris replaced Joe Biden on the Democratic ticket, most of Kennedy's liberal support moved to her. That left Kennedy's more conservative followers, giving him spoiler potential to hurt Trump. This shakeup could put enough votes up for grabs to make the difference. Embracing Kennedy, however, is risky, tying Trump to a lot of RFK Jr.'s outlandish ideas. Outlandish is putting it mildly, said Rex Hubke in USA Today. An even weird won't suffice. The Trump J.D. Vance ticket became roughly 17 billion times more bananas when Trump accepted the endorsement of a noted Dead Bear Club carcass hauler and anti-vax wackadoodle who claims the CIA controls the press and has been vehemently disavowed by his distraught Kennedy clan. With his craven capitulation to Trump, Kennedy becomes unworthy of his name, said his brother Max Kennedy in the Los Angeles Times. Trump is exactly the kind of arrogant, entitled bully my father used to prosecute. Before making his sordid deal with Trump, my brother first offered to endorse Harris in exchange for a role in her White House, and she refused. It's especially hypocritical that my brother has now destroyed his credentials as an environmentalist to back a man who chants drill, baby, drill, and claims climate change is a Chinese hoax. I love Bobby, but I hate what he is doing to our country. A few of the short notes. At least 2,325 Americans have died from heat last year, 603 more than in 2022, and the most in more than two decades of records. Those official figures are likely well below the actual numbers, say researchers who have charted a sharp rise in heat-related deaths starting around 2016. The boom in legal sports betting is leading Americans to take money from their stock brokerage accounts to fund online wagers, according to a new academic study. It found that households bet an average of $1,100 in the 38 states that have legalized sports gambling since 2018. Meanwhile, stock market investments by households in those states dropped by an average of 14% following legalization. During his 96 hours in Chicago for the Democratic Convention, Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg made more than 30 TV, radio, and TikTok appearances, gave 30 speeches to constituent groups, spoke at 12 delegation breakfasts, and delivered a primetime address. About 12% of the nation's 870 active federal judges are age 65 or over and eligible to retire on full pay or take semi-retirement, but have chosen not to. Federal judges have lifetime appointments, and the oldest full-time member of the bench is Judge Pauline Newman, 97, appointed to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit by President Ronald Reagan in 1984. And we can finish with a couple of short quotes. Maya Angelou says, "Life loves to be taken by the lapel and told, I am with you, kid. Let's go." And Ogden Nash says, "You're only young once, but you could be immature forever." With that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you have enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.